Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast, an intelligent, imaginative, hospitable exploration of ideas that matter in contemporary life. And now, here's your host, Dick Staub.
Hi, this is Dick Staub with another encore presentation of The Dick Staub Show, conversations with thoughtful creatives and cultural influencers about their life, work, and personal journey. Today, we continue our conversation with Thomas Oden, the author of The Rebirth of Orthodoxy. Well, this is Dick Staub back with you. Our guest is Thomas Oden, theologian, professor of theology and ethics at Drew University. He's got a book out titled The Rebirth of Orthodoxy, Signs of New Life in Christianity. It's published by Harper San Francisco. We were just talking about a 5th century monk who described orthodoxy around that which has been believed everywhere, always, and by all. Talk about the significance of those phrases, Tom, as we think about orthodoxy.
Right. He actually went through a process of a kind of data-gathering process in order to find out what the key leading minds of his thought, of his period, thought about how do you distinguish truth from falsehood.
Yeah.
Well, of course, you go to Scripture first, but what if there is a controversy about Scripture? Then what you appeal to, what you trust as a matter of faith, is the same faith that the church has confessed the world over. That's the first criterion everywhere. That's a space criterion, a universality criterion.
Yeah.
The second one is you trust the same faith that was confessed by the apostles. That's what he called the criterion of antiquity. You go back to the apostolic testimony in every case. So that if there's a controverted question, you have a way to settle it by means of appealing to the apostles.
Yep.
The third one, though, is more complex. It involves a deliberative process of gaining conciliar consent. That is, you're trying to get where you have controversies that are still unsettled after these first two criteria have been met. You then trust those views of faith, or that view of faith that has had cross-cultural generations of general consent.
Yeah.
That's what is meant by all.
Now, it is your position that there are elements of our faith tradition that have been carried on throughout the centuries, not necessarily embodied institutionally, but through the work of the Spirit, that there has always been this kind of orthodox core that has survived
right.
all of the different shifts. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, the whole orthodox core has survived. There has never been a time in which the small c case orthodox have not believed that Jesus Christ is Lord.
Yes.
There's never been a time when they did not believe in the resurrection.
Yeah.
In other words, there's a whole body of confession that gathers up the central confession of the apostolic testimony.
Now, one of the interesting aspects that you describe in this book is a new ecumenicity that is embraced by Catholics, Orthodox, and evangelicals.
Yeah.
And you do a little contrasting of what the ecumenical movement looked like in the Riverside Drive model, and how this is different from that.
Right. Keep in mind that evangelicals have been, have in many ways been a rival movement to what we normally call the ecumenical movement.
Yes, absolutely.
They've been very dissatisfied with it, and rightly so, because each decade the modern ecumenical movement has proceeded, it is more and more accommodated, not simply to modern culture, but to some of the most the worst aspects of modern culture, like moral relativism, like sexual experimentation and so forth.
Yeah.
Now, what I mean by the new ecumenism is really a return to ancient ecumenism.
Yeah.
There's nothing that the World Council of Churches and the National Council of Churches had really less vital interest in many of, well, there are some exceptions, faith and order movement, but basically they were not interested in really recovering the wholeness of Catholic faith, that is, the ancient Christian faith.
Yeah.
What is now occurring among Protestants, Pentecostals, Charismatics, and Catholic and Orthodox all across the board is a rediscovery of what we own and share and celebrate together over 20 centuries.
What's interesting, though, is that, and this is my limited realm of observation, but it seems to me that it is particularly robust among younger generations, that there is a whole generation of younger Christians who have been either raised in evangelicalism or within the Orthodox tradition or within Catholicism, who have on their own concluded that what they are really looking for and hungering for is found in the past, not in the rootlessness of the present. Is that true, or are you seeing it in a much broader scale?
I think it is my students who have taught me to take seriously the ancient Christian texts and interpreters. I've come to call them the young fogies. these are the people that have been most vocal in their dissatisfaction with what they've learned in universities. Keep in mind that I teach in a post-university situation. I teach in a graduate school and in a seminary.
Yeah.
And so I get students that have been thoroughly indoctrinated by the university.
Yeah.
And now they are asking, why did they have to learn all that stuff, when now they realize that much of it has been, and even the best of it, has been largely forgotten within the context of university education.
What's interesting is within evangelicalism, you know, when I was in seminary way back in the 70s, there was an acknowledgement of the importance of the patristics, but being a Protestant and evangelically oriented seminary, I was at Gordon Conwell Seminary in the early 70s, there was a passing interest in patristics, but it wasn't viewed as core. You're finding among a lot of the new, younger church leaders obviously a deep and firm commitment to the Word, but a deep appreciation for the patristics, because they bring this what has been believed everywhere, always, and by all perspective to the text that affirms what their own spiritual sense of what is true is. Is that how you're seeing patristics work themselves into evangelical circles?
Right. If you read the Reformation writers themselves, Luther, Calvin, the Anglican writers, you will find that they all were all deeply informed by the classical Christian consensus.
Yeah.
In other words, Luther, as an Augustinian, was not ignorant of Augustine.
Yeah.
Calvin was, in fact, a very serious scholar of the patristic writers.
Yeah.
But in the last 100 years or so, evangelicals have tended to see the Reformation as the normative period.
Yes. So they've been drinking from the waters of Calvin and everything else, but not going back to Calvin's
exactly,
roots.
Yes. And revivalism, in a way, God has worked powerfully through revivalism, but in a way, revivalism has intensified the problem by focusing on my experience here and now.
Yes.
Rather than the history of God's work in the people of God throughout generations and generations.
Well, and I think that's why this book is getting on to something that's so important for the next generation of believers. I mean, I believe that every generation has to rediscover the faith for themselves, but part of the discovery process is through understanding the great tradition and that which has survived martyrdom and great challenges and tests throughout all of the ages and has stayed robust and true and is the core of our faith. And that's, I think, what some in the younger generation are missing, and in finding it, will find the roots that they're seeking. We're going to be back with more of Thomas Oden. Join us next time for a continuation of our conversation with Thomas Oden. Thank you for listening to The Kindling's Muse. If this program sparks something in you, I invite you to participate at www.thekindlings.com. That's KINDLINGS. Share this program, tell a friend, or just leave a comment at www.thekindlings.com.